This is, the title of the presentation here is also the title of a book that I am just in the process of finishing. It's a big book, some 10 chapters long, and each of the chapters is pretty long too. So it's titled From the Land Ethic to the Earth Ethic, Environmental Ethics in a Time of Global Climate Change. I think that in some ways the environmental ethics that had been created from the inception of environmental ethics, which we can date as a philosophical activity from 1973, that's when the first papers were published. So through the end of the 20th century, you might say that environmental ethics occupied about a quarter century. And it's my worry and concern that the scale of the focus of environmental ethics in that quarter century was not proportionate to the scale, temporal and spatial scale, of global climate change. And so I think that we have to rethink environmental ethics really from the ground up because of the of this new scale of a of an environmental concern that has in some sense eclipsed and entrained all of our previous environmental concerns. By eclipsed, I mean that's mostly what we're talking about, and entrained in the sense that it it exacerbates many of the problems that we previously recognized. For example, the problem of the loss of biodiversity is worsened by the advent of global climate change. So that's the context for the presentation. So first of all, just to give you a brief review of the background of environmental philosophy, when a new sort of discipline comes online, I think we look for ancestors, precursors, and the triumvirate here is Henry David Thoreau, John Muir, and Aldo Leopold. I think that we could categorize Thoreau as an anthropocentric thinker. He speaks of the higher uses of nature, the aesthetic and spiritual, as well as the material. In my estimation, or at least in so far as I've been able to determine, John Muir was the first person to actually speak of the rights of nature in a posthumously published book called A Thousand Mile Walk to the Gulf. He talks about the rights of snakes, bears, and alligators. He was walking across the swamps of Florida and was deathly afraid of alligators, but he says God loves alligators as much as any saint, and he concludes by saying, may you enjoy your flowery wilds and have a bite of frightened man for dainty, something to that effect. It's really quite quite nice. And then Aldo Leopold, with the famous summary moral maxim, or golden rule of the land ethic, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity and stability and beauty of the biotic community, is wrong when it tends otherwise, is both non-anthropocentric, but unlike Muir, focused on individual animals here, holistic, because it is the biotic community that is the focus of concern, not so much the individual members that compose it. I have devoted most of my scholarly and philosophical efforts to the development of the philosophy of Aldo Leopold. He's the most recent and the most systematic of the precursors that I just identified. And he's also, in some ways, the most, it's hard to say that he's more influential than Thoreau, or better known, but within the community of environmentalists and conservationists, Aldo Leopold, I think, has been the most influential. He was hailed as a prophet because he anticipated the environmental crisis before it happened in the 1960s. His book, Sand County Almanac, is called The Bible of the Environmental Movement. As I mentioned, his land ethic is more systematic. It's a single essay, runs for 25 pages. It attempts to sustain a discussion of environmental ethics, and so it became the seminal text for academic environmental ethics, especially for me. And I think, as I was saying, among environmentalists and conservationists, Leopold is the touchstone for their own sense of ethical responsibility to nature. Now, as it turns out, in the whole corpus of Leopold's work, he only really wrote three essays that were specifically devoted to ethics. The first one, in 1923, was Some Fundamentals of Conservation in the Southwest, but it lay around unpublished until 1979, when Gene Hargrove, whom Eleanor mentioned, the founding editor of the journal Environmental Ethics, founded in the archives of the University of Wisconsin and published it posthumously. And it turns out to be the sketch of a Gaian ethic based on respect somehow for the earth as a living thing. Then in 1933, exactly 10 years later, Leopold wrote The Conservation Ethic, which is very interesting because it's not really philosophical. It's much more, how shall I say, sort of green politics in a way. It talks about boycotting dirty stuff, buying green and clean, and doesn't really provide any sort of philosophical foundations. And then the land ethic, which was the capstone essay of his masterwork, his masterpiece, A Sand County Almanac, has, in my opinion, both, he's drawing expressly on both Darwinian evolutionary, Darwin's evolutionary account of ethics, and specifically on a certain paradigm in ecology, the community concept or the community paradigm, best articulated by Charles Elton in 1927. Now, what I am going to basically argue here in this particular talk is that the ecological scale of the 1949 Leopold Land Ethic is a poor fit for the global scale long-term environmental concerns that have now descended upon us, and that actually the 1923 Leopold Earth Ethic is perhaps a better fit. Some of my colleagues say, well, why Leopold? You know, Callicott, you've been around long enough, you can develop your own damn earth ethic. You don't need to ride the horse of Aldo Leopold to here to death. And the answer to that question really is twofold. One, there's a personal answer, and that is my work has been so closely associated with Leopold for my entire scholarly corpus, that I would like to express some continuity with the past work. And the other reason is that the Leopold brand today is so much increasing in value, shall we say, and to be able to put the Leopold brand on a on this philosophy that I'm developing, I think will help to, forgive me for putting it this way, sell it in the intellectual community. I know that that's very reductive and probably something that I shouldn't be saying here, but nevertheless. Here are just a few images of Leopold during the course of his life. By the way, he was a graduate of the Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, and they just had in 2009 the 100th anniversary of his graduation, a nice celebration there, which of course I attended, and it was all very nice. And he was declared to be the most distinguished graduate of the forestry school at Yale University. So first of all, I'd like to sort of develop now just to see what's going on when philosophers try to take on the task of, I like to somewhat put it this way, the land ethic is like the tip of the iceberg, conceptually speaking. Leopold wasn't a philosopher, and I want to sort of sound the intellectual and the conceptual depths of it, because I think it has those depths, and these need to be made more visible. And that's what a philosopher's task might well be. So Leopold gives us some clues as to where to look for these conceptual foundations through, not footnotes, he doesn't use those academic vehicles, but through rhetorical allusion. He says all ethics so far evolved rest upon a single premise that the individual is a member of a community of interdependent parts. Ecology simply enlarges the boundary of the community to include soils, waters, plants, and animals, or collectively the land. A land ethic changes the role of Homo sapiens. Notice he uses our biological designation, putting us basically in the zoo, so to speak, with the other animals, from conqueror of the land, community, to plain member and citizen of it. It implies respect for his fellow members and also respect for the community as such, that is to say, as a whole. So, following up on these clues, when we turn to Darwin's Descent of Man, we read something very, very different in spirit than we read in The Origin of Species, which was all about struggle and competition and survival of the fittest and so forth and so on, whereas The Descent of Man, much of it is about cooperation, about collectivity, and so on. And I think that Darwin's task in The Descent of Man is to bring his account of the origins of, to bring his account of all of the distinctive features of human nature into his evolutionary account. He has to be able to show how various capacities that seem so different and unique from in comparison with the other animals actually have nascent and incipient forms in other animal behaviors, and that we can see how through natural selection these might have been nurtured through natural selection to become the capacities that we have, such as intelligence and so on. He talks about how apes can form a scheme to plunder a garden and vocalization as the origins of language, and he even suggests that dogs howling at the moon events a certain superstition that could eventually become religion and so forth and so on. I mean, it's actually quite entertaining, the anecdotal style that Darwin uses. But ethics is probably the hardest case, because it would seem that in the competition for limited resources, the struggle for existence in which winners take all and losers don't die, don't survive, and don't reproduce, that are more aggressive, are more treacherous tendencies would be increased through the process of natural selection, and that ethics, looking out for the other's interest, having sympathy, sacrificing oneself for others in the group would be cut off by the process of natural selection and never have a chance to become fixed in the species. So Darwin's solution to this problem is, as all good scientific solutions are, is very simple and very straightforward, and that is simply that human beings survive, well, not just best, but we can only survive in the context of a social whole, and that we pursue life struggle collectively. And what makes society possible is the evolution of certain restraints on our more aggressive behavior, and these basically not through any kind of intelligence, but rather through a selection of certain emotional capacities, what Hume called the moral sentiments, sympathy, a sense of loyalty to the group, and so on. So I think that this quote from The Descent of Man captures Darwin's idea in a nutshell. No tribe could hold together, he says, if murder, robbery, treachery, etc., were common, hence such crimes within the limits of the same tribe are branded with everlasting infamies, quoting some other rhetorician there. So simply, if a tribe cannot hold together, its members would perish and fail to reproduce. So ethics evolved by natural selection as a means to social organization. Very simple and direct. It's vital to the inclusive fitness of the individual members of the community. So this leads then to a lemma that ethics in society and community are correlative. And in other words, that we can perhaps understand the differences that we often see in ethics that we sometimes think of as sort of cultural relativism as the adaptation of a given set of rules to the particular structure of a community, so that as the community changes in scope and in form, then the ethics have to sort of be adjusted in order to sustain or support the community. So the corollary then is that as society evolves, ethics evolve in parallel. They evolve really in two ways. On the left-hand side is in terms of scope or size, and on the right-hand side, I'm just giving a single example of a virtue that is associated with a given kind of a social organization. So in the case of the extended family or clan, the primary virtue would be self-sacrifice. In a tribal situation, it's a gift economy. This is something that we economists unfortunately have failed, I think, to fully understand, that barter is not even the first economy. It's gift exchange with the expectation of reciprocity, though you would never say so because that would be rude. So you visit, one tribe visits another and they give them gifts and exchange and so on. As tribes merge into ethnic nations and agriculture develops, then property rights come into view. With the nation state, of course, we're very aware of the virtue of patriotism. And I might add that in 1948, the United Nations issued its Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which in some sense is the ethic of the global village that emerged after the Second World War. Darwin interestingly anticipates this development. He says, as man advances in civilization and small tribes are united in the larger communities, the simplest reason would tell each individual that he ought to extend his social instincts and sympathies to all the members of the same nation, though personally unknown to him. This point being once reached, there is only an artificial barrier to prevent his sympathies extending to to the men of all nations and races. That was prescient in some ways. So those are the evolutionary foundations, very simply expressed, of the land ethic. What about the ecological foundations? Well, in the history of ecology, one of the major paradigms, and an early one, and one that still remains very, very alive and well in ecology, is the community concept. And that's basically like that we think that the biota is organized somewhat like human societies. Elton, like Darwin, is a very readable writer, and he actually describes the niche, which is a technical term in ecology, of course, as a role or a profession in the economy of nature. One charming remark that he makes is that when the ecologist sees a badger, he should think, there goes the vicar, looking at the animal in terms of its role in the society. So I think that Leopold actually is not very creative where the land ethic is concerned. He just takes the cake, the conceptual cake that Darwin developed, and adds a layer to it, and that's simply the biotic community. So just as we have, as Darwin envisioned, the extended family as a social unit, which merges into the ethnic nation, and then the nation state, and finally the global village, now ecology has made us aware that we inhabit not only all of these other social wholes or communities, but we're members of a biotic community as well. And so if the simplest reason, again, Darwin would tell each individual that he ought to extend his social instincts and sympathies to all the members of this new larger group, well, the same would apply, Leopold hopes, and tries to persuade us where the biotic community is concerned. Now, so much then, these are the, just a sketch of the conceptual foundations of the Leopold land ethic, which I'm abbreviating as L-E-L-L-E here. Developments in the science of ecology, one of the things that I teach in the graduate school is the philosophy of ecology, so I track the developments in ecology actually very closely. And the land ethic was composed in 1949. There's been a lot of, shall we say, scientific water under the bridge, a lot of development in ecology, which in many ways does not really support the same idea anymore that Leopold developed. For example, biotic communities are what some people call fuzzy entities. Their spatial boundaries are vague and porous. When ecologists began to look closely at what was perceived to be the same community type, this forest is like that forest, this grassland is like that, but then they start to count the plants and animals that compose it, these same communities are not really that similar to one another. Further, biotic communities are dynamic at multiple temporal scales. The temporal boundaries between successional stages are also vague. So the temporal boundaries as well as the spatial boundaries are fuzzy. Successional change is not directional, terminating in a stable self-replicating climax. And one of the discoveries of the 1970s and 80s was the ubiquity of natural disturbance by fire, flood, drought, wind, which is frequent and often rhythmic. So there's little integrity or stability associated with biotic communities to be preserved. So I think, however, and this is the subject of some subsequent essays of mine, that the Leopold land ethic can be, quote unquote, dynamized. After all, it's built on an analogy between biotic communities and human communities, And so if we think about human communities, they're kind of fuzzy too. I was talking to Laurent on our way in, and he was telling me that Brussels is surrounded by a number of smaller communities where people live, they pay taxes there, they work here. Where does, you know, how do we really delineate this particular community? And yet there is an identifiable thing, right, nonetheless. If such human communities are robust enough to generate duties and obligations, I would say biotic communities are no worse. And Leopold does recognize that nature is dynamic. However, he was thinking really only at an evolutionary scale. And I think that we can add other changes and disturbances to the land ethic. And I have done something that would be on the order among many of my friends of trying to edit the Bible, the conservation movement here, and have suggested substituting a thing is right when it tends to disturb the biotic community only at normal temporal and spatial scales. It is wrong when it tends otherwise, because natural disturbance could be a norm for what we can tolerate where human disturbance is concerned without being outside the scope or scale of nature. No, I think that the Leopold land ethic remains useful, but it is also limited. So once we sort of modernize it and make it consistent with contemporary ecology, I think it's still a viable environmental ethic. It's ethically useful in ethically evaluating community up to landscape scale and rapid and reversible human disturbances, such as point source pollution, agriculture and forestry practices, and recreational activities and local development. But where it's limited is in terms of larger global scale, long-term, and possibly irreversible human disturbances, such as climate change, the sixth great extinction, and the stratospheric ozone hole. I think that the environmental crisis has really happened in two waves, as I call it. The first one was in the 1960s. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, other documents, our own senses revealed to us that we had polluted water, we had smog in the air, we had insidious chemicals being released into the environment, but all of those were at a smaller scale. We could identify sources, we could remedy them, but now, with the second wave of the environmental crisis, which washed over us in the 1980s, we suddenly became aware of these more global scale changes. And by the way, the very first philosopher to really recognize this shift was a French philosopher, Michel Serres, in Le Contrat Naturel. And he says in a quite dramatic way, he does tend to be a bit flamboyant, in his writing that this globality is something brand new in philosophy that we've never really confronted. So I think that it's very important to give credit where credit is due. And Michel Serres, I think, Le Contrat Naturel appeared, I believe, in 1990. These phenomena really came to wide public attention in the 1980s. So, where do we discover the kind of inspiration in order to deal with this challenge that Michel Serres was the first to identify? So again, back to Leopold and his 1923 some fundamentals of conservation in the Southwest. I'm quoting on two slides extensive text because the text is so, I think, so strong. He writes, it is at least not impossible to regard the Earth's parts, soil, mountains, rivers, atmosphere, etc., as organs or parts of organs of a coordinated whole, each part with a definite function. And if we could see this whole as a whole through a great period of time, we might perceive not only organs with coordinated functions, but possibly also that process of consumption and replacement, which in biology we call the metabolism or growth. In such a case, we would have all the visible attributes of a living thing, which we do not now recognize to be such because it is too big and its process is too slow. And there would also follow that invisible attribute, a soul or consciousness, which many philosophers of all ages ascribe to all living things and aggregations thereof, including the dead earth. I read this immediately when it was published in 1979. It was in the spring in Wisconsin, which means it's still winter. And so I went outside just because I was in such a state of wonder. And the northern lights, the aurora borealis, were so dramatic that evening, they actually went beyond the celestial equator into the southern sky, just green light show, basically. And I thought at the time, I am seeing the soul or consciousness of the planet here, because what is our own consciousness except the electromagnetic activity of our brains, right? And so that's what the aurora borealis is. It's like the Earth receiving cosmic information, you know, from the universe and funneling it into its magnetic field and then producing this effect. Now, as I say in such circumstances, don't ask me what I was smoking that evening, but that was indeed my experience. This goes on. There is not much discrepancy except in language between this conception of a living earth and the conception of a dead earth with enormously slow, intricate, and interrelated functions among its parts, as given us by physics, chemistry, and geology. The essential thing for present purposes is that both admit the interdependent functions of the elements. Possibly in our intuitive perceptions, which may be truer than our science and less impeded by words than our philosophies, we realize the indivisibility of the earth, its soil, mountains, rivers, forests, climate, plants, animals, and respect it collectively. That's the ethical payoff here. Not only as a useful servant, instrumentally, as we would say in environmental philosophy today, but a living being, vastly less alive than ourselves in degree, but vastly greater than ourselves in time and space. A being that was old when the morning stars sang together and when the last of us has been gathered unto his fathers will still be young. It's not accidental that Leopold's work has this biblical flavor. He studied the Bible more for rhetorical than devotional purposes. And the phrase, when the morning stars sang together, is a quotation from the book of Job. And when the last of us has been gathered unto his fathers is from the Kings, book of Kings. So these biblical allusions, just sort of embedded into the text here, give it a kind of profundity and an authority that we in the West, because of our Sunday school education, so to speak, where we resonate with in subliminal ways that we might not immediately recognize. I had read this. I never, you know, I wasn't a student of the Bible, so I had no idea that these were biblical phrases until I started to really look into this with the help of Google. So in this essay, Leopold develops three foundations for an earth ethic. The first is a kind of individual and collective virtue ethics. He has previously quoted Ezekiel, and he says, Ezekiel seems to scorn waste, pollution, and unnecessary damage as something unworthy, something damaging not only to the reputation of the waster, but to the self-respect of the craft and the society of which he is a member. And this is just sort of mentioned in passing. Then he moves on to what we might call long anthropocentrism, responsibility to future generations. He says, the privilege of possessing the earth entails the responsibility of passing it on, the better for our use, not only to immediate posterity, but to the unknown future. And by the way, that distinction, I think, is vitally important. I'll try to return to this, the difference between immediate posterity and the unknown future, or that is to say, distant future generations. And finally, a kind of Kantian non-anthropocentrism, respect for the earth's intrinsic value. It's possible that Ezekiel respected the soil not only as a craftsman respects his material, but as a moral being respects a living thing. And that idea is the one that Leopold sort of settles on and then develops.